This is tape two of the conversation. Mr. Gunn, proceed. Are you aware of that division of impulse? Or does it mean anything to you?
Yes, unfortunately, I am aware of the impulse you just referred to, that there are some Negroes who attempt to lose their identity to the Negro community. And as they become more affluent, they seem to have less identity with the Negro community. And in many instances, this is manifested in the fact that they may leave a particular church affiliation with a Negro church or a predominantly Negro church and go to a predominantly white church. In many instances, they may try to associate with others of different racial backgrounds and racial identifications, and they will not, in many instances, identify with the so-called Negro civil rights movement for various reasons, and they tend to feel that possibly since they live in a nice neighborhood and they have a good job and they enjoy the privileges of first-class citizenship they feel, that they cannot readily identify with the Negro cause per se. I am painfully aware of this, but I feel that recently here in Cleveland, we have found a rallying point, and many of these people have realigned themselves on the cause of the Negro, and they have realigned themselves with civil rights organizations in this city. But I'm aware of this problem.
A significant shift has taken place, though, you feel, here?
Yes, I feel that there has been a significant shift. I don't know whether it is a permanent shift, but I have seen some of my friends. I alluded to the fact earlier that we had a meeting of 25 or 30 Negro leaders, and many of these people in this particular meeting, I'm sure, are of the opinion and the feeling that you just mentioned, that they have somewhat lost their identity. And I can say that there was not complete unanimity in conversation, but there was complete unanimity when a decision was finally called for. I know that there are those who feel this way, and there are those Negroes who do not want to antagonize their dear white friends. But when the chips were down, they had to take a stand. And I feel that many of them did not want to be called Uncle Toms. And this had already been
banded. This
has been banded about. This was what was being said when the meeting was first announced in the newspapers. It was leaked by someone to the newspapers, and Negroes immediately started saying that these were just a bunch of Uncle Toms being called to this meeting. They did not know, for instance, many people I talked to, that I had been invited, and that several other fellows who had been active in the civil rights movement had been invited.
Isn't that part of a tradition, almost a traditional feeling among Negroes, to assume that success, in the ordinary standard of success, mean that the Negro who has succeeded has moved out into the white world and potentially cut his ties? Isn't that a fairly common feeling among the masses of Negroes?
It may be. I cannot always speak for the masses, but you see here where I live.
Sure.
And I don't think that there has been any undercurrent of criticism against me for my participation. I don't know whether most Negroes even know where I live. But certainly they do not feel that maybe because I have reached a certain position that I will sell them down the proverbial river, or that I'm an Uncle Tom, because I'm not. And I've been very forceful in the civil rights movement here.
Well, I know you have. That's not what's at stake. It's a question of whether they're split between the mass of Negroes, the really deprived mass, and the constantly enlarging group of Negroes of considerable or great success. Do you think
I think that there is not the obvious split Because we all can identify when there is a reason for identifying. We all identify together, regardless of our status. Because as I have often remarked to my white friends, no matter how high I may rise, no matter where I may move, no matter how much money I may have or may make, I'm still a Negro. And the lowest grade of white man will look at me and feel that he's better than I am. Though he may not have as much money as I have, though he may not live in a house comparable to mine, but he feels he's better than I am.
One analysis of this, of the new Negro movement, is that it's primarily a sort of a middle and upper class movement that is successful, or more or less successful Negroes who have felt suddenly the cramp of success, just as you described it. But that has been the cutting edge provided the leadership group. Professional people, by and large, and teachers.
Well, I think that you may have a correct analysis there, that the leadership in the civil rights movement here in Cleveland, basically, is comprised of people who are those who have the ability, they have the education, possibly have attained a certain status in the community, and they are providing leadership. I think the real difference is this, that in the past, Negroes who have attained the status that you refer to have not wanted to serve as in the leadership role to the extent of causing discomfiture in the majority community.
And now they'll take the risk.
And well, there are some who are willing to take the risk, and I think that basically they're the young fellows who are willing to take this risk, because in the past, many of your so-called Negro leaders have been rewarded for their attainment of success by being given jobs with the government or with the governmental agencies within the city, appointments to boards and agencies where they can draw a salary. And naturally, when you're in this position, you don't want to rock the boat too much for fear of disturbing the source of income. Whereas here in Cleveland today, those individuals who are taking part in the civil rights movement basically are those who have no responsibility to governmental agencies. They are those who have jobs where they can work in civil rights, or they're in their own profession. And they have nothing that they can necessarily lose or that is given to them by the white community.
They're not living on patronage of any kind.
That's right. And as a result, they feel much freer to serve as leaders in the civil rights movement in Cleveland.
Let me cut to something else, Mr. Garden. Going back to the matters of demonstrations, now, some Negroes, some importance and authority would say there are two types of demonstrations, a legitimate demonstration and an illegitimate, put it this way, use those words loosely. One being, the first being, demonstrations directed at particular targets, you see. Now, a distinction would occur for some people in the stall ends as illegitimate, the fair ground demonstrations as legitimate, having a special target. And not being antisocial, generally having a particular make a particular point. Would this distinction make any sense to you as a lawyer?
Yes, I think that really what we have tried to do in Cleveland, though some people disagree that this has been our technique, we have tried to relate our demonstrations to something fundamental, something real.
Some specific target.
Some specific target. Rather than going off on a tangent and stopping traffic on Lakeshore Boulevard, for instance, because of discrimination in the schools. We try to relate it to a specific problem. Now, there are those who feel that this was not done in the case of certain schools. We first started demonstrating, as far as the educational problem is concerned, around the Board of Education last fall. We had 200 or 300 pickets walking around the entire block where the Board of Education is situated. And then this past winter in January, when it was rather cold, we had pickets around the Board of Education. This did not seem to help. So we were picketing because of the segregation of bus-transported children. Negro children were being segregated in the receiving schools where they were being transported. So after picketing the Board of Education, then we shifted our focus from the Board of Education out to the receiving schools where these Negro children were located. And this was the first time that we had violence in Cleveland as far as demonstrations are concerned. Our pickets were peaceful, and I want to stress that. Our pickets were peaceful demonstrators. They marched with dignity, with a purpose, and they were not violent. But the white neighbors living in this neighborhood where we went, they spat upon our pickets, they pushed them, they shoved them, they drove automobiles up on the sidewalk curb and almost struck our pickets.
Is this the Italian section?
No, this was not the... Well, there are Italians living out in this section, too. This was out at Brett and Memorial School. Now, there were police there, and the police made no arrest, even though there were indications that the police saw these various assaults taking place. Then, a few days after this demonstration, we proceeded to decide to demonstrate at Murray Hill School. This was another receiving school, and this is an Italian neighborhood, just about all Italian. We did not even reach the site of this school because the people were so belligerent and antagonistic. As we gathered at a parking lot down near Western Reserve University, preparing to march up to Murray Hill School, we received word that there were a lot of people gathered around this school. They were very belligerent, and we were told that there probably would be bloodshed and possibly death if we walked up there. There were police there, and unfortunately, these police did not protect the innocent victims who were up in that neighborhood because there were Negroes who accidentally drove through the neighborhood, not affiliated with the Civil Rights Movement, whose cars were stoned and some of them were struck. Two Negro reporters were chased. White reporters' cameras were smashed. One white reporter was up on the third floor taking pictures and the second floor, and they threatened to throw him off the porch if he did not surrender his film. And this was the type of conduct that we had up at this school. Negroes had fruit and vegetables thrown at them. One of my very close friends, a member of my church, a lawyer, he had to seek refuge to protect himself because he came up to picket, not knowing that we had decided not to picket. And this was generally a chaotic situation there. Police actually saw the law being violated, but they made no arrest. No arrests were made. And this gives you an idea as to what some people felt was wrong. They said they were up there to protect their children. Why, all these demonstrations were peaceful, so there was no reason to protect their children, and particularly to protect their children with violence. We arranged these demonstrations so they would occur when the children were in class and not when they were coming to school or leaving school. We specifically did this so the children would not see the demonstrators. And they all stated that we made children the pawns of the situation and that the children would be disturbed by this. Well, the children should not have seen it, because they were in school. Now, many people said that this was a wrong place to demonstrate, because the Board of Education headquarters was where the decision was made.
What kind? Who said it was wrong to demonstrate?
Well, the newspapers said it was wrong to demonstrate out at these school sites, and many white citizens said we were wrong for doing this. Now, I feel that this is not a situation that is illegal demonstration or unlawful demonstration, as it was related to something that was going on in those schools.
You had a clear target.
Okay. We had a clear target right in the schools where we were demonstrating.
How did you feel about the stall-ins as compared with the actual demonstrations in the fairgrounds, depicting a particular pavilions in those? Is that distinction apply
there? Well, I
think
there is a distinction. But really, I'm not one of the persons who is way out on the demonstration question. But sometimes I feel that these things are necessary.
Which things are we talking about now?
The stall-ins. Now, maybe I would not participate in a stall-in, But I would have no objection to others doing this if they felt that this was necessary in their community. Evidently, there were not many people who agreed with the fellow from Brooklyn
because
it was not effective.
No, it's
but really, if they feel this is necessary in some locality, I would have no objection to it.
Clearly, there was a big split of opinion on the stall. That is, people who are perfectly willing to demonstrate in the fairgrounds on particular targets and go to jail for it would not condone the stalling, as we know from the fact of the whole debate between the central office of CORE and the Brooklyn and the New York.
The only thing I can say is this. If you're willing to go to jail, does it make much difference for what reason you're going to jail?
Well, the question would be this. What's your relation to society? Not because of jail, but because of the thing you did.
Well, to my mind, when you're doing something to subject yourself to arrest, it's wrong, regardless of whether it's killing a man or whether it's stabbing a man and injuring him or shooting someone and injuring him. This is wrong. Now, one is worse than the other, of course. A murder or a homicide is worse than maybe stealing a nickel candy bar. But they're both wrong. And I would hate they're illegal. I would hate to equate stealing a candy bar with murder or homicide. Yeah. But if you're going to do something, commit an offense that is comparable in severity of punishment, I can see no difference between stalling in on the highway or causing a disturbance inside the fairground. If you have committed yourself to this type of law violation, I see nothing wrong with it. Maybe this would shake the people up in New York a little bit. Maybe it would have been a good thing if 3,000 Negroes had stalled their automobiles on the highways leading to the fairgrounds. Maybe this would have dramatized to the city of New York and to this entire country that Negroes are dissatisfied with their lot. And I hesitate to even reach this point because I am fundamentally a lawyer first, and I'm in favor of maintaining the law at all times. But it disturbs me in this country of mine that we must do the many things we do to gain just the smallest measure of success as far as our request for rights are concerned. I often say that my wife and I went to Europe last summer, and we traveled throughout Europe, not all over Europe, but we went to 10 countries. At no time was I aware of any discrimination in Europe. Now, I'm not a citizen of Europe. I'm a citizen of the United States. But I traveled all over Europe. I stayed in hotels. I ate in restaurants without question all over Europe, the part that I was in, the parts. But in my own country, several years ago, my wife and I drove to Seattle, and we took a plane and flew up to Alaska, stayed there several weeks, and then came back down to Seattle, drove to California, then came back to the southern part of the United States, through the southwest part. And when we reached Tucumcari, New Mexico, we were refused accommodations at a motel in Tucumcari, New Mexico. Now, I know this happens in our country, because I have been aware of this for many, many years, having lived in Kansas City, where a Negro could not even go to a white hotel when I was living there. It's different now. But you wonder, what do you have to do in this country to be accorded full citizenship rights when the Constitution is existent, when the Bill of Rights is existent, when we profess to be a democracy, when we profess to be basically a Christian nation? What do you have to do to shock the consciences of the people in this country? In order that they will treat me as a human being, in order that they will give me all the rights that anyone else is entitled to, when I can go to Europe and have no trouble at all, but I couldn't go to Mississippi and have the same feeling or treatment that I get in Europe.
Mr. Evers, Charles Evers, told me two or three months ago now, that he had much more hope of an early settlement in Mississippi than he had for it outside of the South.
I think he's right. You know, this is a great problem, and I think this is what is bothering people in Cleveland and throughout the North. You know, it was so easy for the northern newspapers, for the northern white people, to criticize Mississippi in the case of the young man Meredith trying to go to the University of Mississippi, and criticizing Alabama when the governor of Alabama was trying to keep Negroes out of the university, and criticizing the governor of New York, of Arkansas, when he tried to keep these little girls out of the high school in Little Rock. And we all said in the North that this was horrible, the way they treat Negroes in the South, and the many things that they do that are inimical to the safety and welfare of Negroes. And when they looked in the papers in the South and saw the picture of the Negro girl on the ground, the policeman, a white policeman's knee in her collar down in Birmingham, the white citizens of the North felt that this was horrible. They deplored what the people in the South were doing. And they just felt that the people in the South should change. Now, when the same thing reaches the North, now many of the northern whites are saying, now, the Negroes should be patient. And you know, you can't achieve all your rights overnight. Now, it was easy for them to criticize the South and say it's wrong for the white people to treat the Negro the way they do in the South. But when the thing comes up in their own backyard or their front yard, and we find that many of the northern white people have the same feeling of hatred and the same feeling toward Negroes that have been sublimated all these years that the southern white man has, the northern whites hate to see this come to fore, and they, in many instances, as you suggest, it will probably be more difficult for us to obtain our rights in the North than it will be in the South.
One of the arguments runs in the South, it's a clear-cut situation. It's by and large a matter of local ordinances and state laws, as well as local practices. The target is clear. The target here is not clear in the North.
That's right. Well, there are many whites here in Cleveland, for instance. I've talked to some. They feel that the Civil Rights Bill is wrong. And I've had some young people. I spoke to a young group over on the west side, in a suburb on the west side. And they felt that it was wrong for the United States government to dictate to a businessman who he should serve in his business. And one young fellow asked me, why is it the Negroes wanted to eat in white restaurants anyhow? Why didn't they eat in Negro restaurants and stay with their own people? And, of course, I asked him, what would he do if someone suggested that, I didn't know what his nationality was, but if he was a German, that he should eat in a German restaurant. And he would forever be forbidden to go to a Chinese restaurant and have Chinese food, or a Hungarian restaurant and have Hungarian food, or to any other type of nationality restaurant and eat. This is a misconception that many northern whites have, that the Civil Rights Bill pending before the Senate today is detracting from the rights of the white businessman and is going to hurt the white community. They don't realize that in the state of Ohio today, we have just about all the laws on the book that are incorporated in the Civil Rights Bill. We have a fair employment law in the state of Ohio. We have a law pertaining to non-discriminatory practices in places of public accommodation. We have a public accommodation law. We have laws that protect the voting rights of Negroes in this state.
You have a housing...
We do not have a fair housing law, but the federal legislation does not have any provision for fair housing. So this, we get repercussions from the white community in the North as to the Civil Rights Bill, when really the Civil Rights Bill will not even have any application to most northern states because we already have the laws. This law is directed primarily to the South, where Negroes do not have the right to go into a place of public accommodation because there are so many laws in states and cities preventing this. And Negroes do not have the right to vote, particularly in Mississippi and some other states. So this is going to bring those rights to those people the same as we have in Ohio. But you get this backlash of criticism from the white communities here in the North against the Civil Rights Bill.
According to the last poll results I saw, you have about 70% of Northerners favoring the accommodation section of the Civil Rights Bill. but about 65% saying they'd move out if, or consider moving out if in their section Negroes moved in. A strange paradox. Accepting public accommodations but resenting apartment house or even subdivision.
Well, you know, this is a funny, it's a paradox, Mr. Warren, that in the South, you know, they often say this, so we Negroes allude to this fact. In the South, the whites don't care where you live. They don't care if you live next door to them. I mean, there are many places in the South where whites and Negroes are living in the same neighborhood. But they don't want you to go to school with their children necessarily. And they don't care, they don't want you to rise above them too much. They don't object to it, but they don't want you going to school with their children. They don't care how high up you go in the South. They don't care whether you live in their neighborhood. But they don't want you to go to school with their children necessarily, or mix socially with them. Now, and go to places where they go socially. In the North, the whites in the North don't care how high you go. They don't care how much education you get. They don't mind you coming into the restaurant, sitting at the next table with them, to them. But they do not want you living in their neighborhood.
That's the point.
This is the thing. They will accept anything but a Negro moving next door to them. Whereas in the South, they will accept your living next door to them, but they don't want you to go to any of their places of public accommodation, going to school with their children. This is an interesting paradox in this country.
It is. Part of that is historical accident, of course. As personal association with Negroes is no rarity in the South. It's quite common.
But it isn't so common in the North.
It's not common in the North.
I've been surprised. I've been on television several times recently and radio. And as a result of these appearances, you get people calling you. And it's surprising the number of whites who call, and eventually I usually ask them whether they are not prejudiced. They always start off their conversation by saying they're not prejudiced. And I always like to dispel their feeling of non-prejudice by asking them whether they would like to have a Negro to move next door to them. And invariably, they just will not accept a Negro living next door to them. And if finally, one lady said that she wouldn't mind my living next door to them because she thought I was a fairly nice person after talking to me on the phone. But they generally, as she said, I don't mind you living next door to me, Mr. Gunn, but I wouldn't want a Negro living on the other side of me. And this is interesting that many of these people don't even know Negroes. They have no contact with Negroes. They have not the slightest conception of how we live. They have not the slightest conception that we have the same desires for nice neighborhoods and nice homes that they have, and we maintain our homes and our neighborhoods when we can afford to maintain them. And it's interesting that they just don't understand. I think that we've had one project in Cleveland that has helped dispel many of these fears. We've had a series of interracial discussion groups called Dialogue, wherein Negroes and whites meet in each other's home, and they discuss problems concerning race relations and things of this nature. Just an attempt to get people together to discuss problems in the racial field. And it has met with fairly good results in this city. And many associations have been made that are more or less ongoing.
You think it's actually modified things? That sort of association? That sort
of... Well, it has its inception in a false type of presentation, in that the people are brought together artificially.
Yeah.
But as a result of this, there have been some continuation of these associations.
That's the test.
And I think the greatest test is when a white person who meets a Negro will eventually or ultimately invite the Negro couple or two Negro couples into his home on a social basis, where he has invited his other white friends who may not have had this exposure. And I think this is the real test of how effective the association has been. And there have been many instances of this being done. I know my wife and I went to one person's home, a couple's home one night, where they had out-of-town guests. from another city in, and they invited several of their friends in, and they had two Negro couples there. And the evening, we spent the whole evening, and there was nothing said about the racial problem. And I feel this is a real test. I'm quite sure that many of their friends were somewhat disturbed or concerned about it. There have been instances. I spoke to a group last Sunday out in Willoughby, Ohio. This is out here near the lake, a suburb east of Cleveland. And this lady had several white couples in, and two or three Negro couples, and I went out to talk to them. And she said before she invited the group, her next-door neighbor came over and talked to her for 2 hours and just told her off, told her how wrong she thought she was for inviting Negroes out in their neighborhood, and just gave her the devil, generally. And she took it and told her neighbor that she thought her neighbor was wrong. But this is the type of abuse that whites have to take when they invite Negroes out into their home. There was one young lady there last Sunday who indicated she lived on the west side of Cleveland in a suburb. And she would not dare invite any Negroes to her home for fear of recriminations from her neighbors. But I say that when a person feels that he is not free to invite someone of a different race to his home, this is partially slavery too.
Yeah.
I mean, you're not free to do what you would like to do.
Yeah.
And this is true of many whites in the South. A lady called me last week. Her son was just sentenced to 1 year in prison down in Chapel Hill, North Carolina.
Was he a demonstrator there?
Yes, he left college to work in this movement. He's from Cleveland. And she went on to say that her son espoused this proposition, that he feels that he is not free when
now
in
is
the
he
South...
Is he a Negro or white?
Oh, he's white. He's white. He lives in one of the suburbs here. And he feels that he is not free when he cannot even go to a Negro restaurant to eat with his Negro friends without fear of being arrested. And now he is in jail. He was sentenced to 1 year at the farm, or labor farm or something like that. And they suspended 2 years with a further condition that he not participate in civil rights demonstrations for 5 years. This is a young white boy.
As long as he stays in North Carolina.
That's right. But this is actually what has happened down in the city. He was going to school at Chapel Hill. I don't know, it's surprising to me that this young man was caught up in this movement, because he lives in a suburb in Cleveland where there are no Negroes living in this particular suburb. So I imagine his exposure to Negroes has been very limited.
It would sound so.
Yes.
Very limited. There's a good deal of resistance, how much I don't know, because you can't assess these things. It's all hearsay to me.
Kind of stopped.